Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And welcome back. This is You, the Owner's Manual Podcast. And today we have an exciting guest as always, but this one's really special. He's kind of the godfather of caregiving for dementia. Written a book in 1981, Dr. Peter Rabbins is author of The 36-Hour Day. I think it's in its fifth edition, which tells you how wonderful it is as a guidepost, as a really a Bible for the caregiver of the Alzheimer's patient, the caregiver of people with dementia in general. But I think it specializes in Alzheimer's specifically. If you want his background in addition, he is a professor in the practice in the Erickson School of Aging Management at the University of Maryland. He's the founding director of the Geriatric Psychiatric Program and the first holder of the Richmond Family Professor of Alzheimer's Disease and Related Disorders at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Rabbins, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Roy.
And am I right? It's the fifth edition of the book, The 36-Hour Day.
Believe it or not, it's actually the sixth is just coming out.
And tell us why you think it has been such a, what I would call, large seller, why it has helped so many. What is it? What was your approach in doing it that made it so wonderful?
Well, our original idea, and I have a co-author, Nancy May, our original idea was that we wanted to do three things. One, give people information. And 40 years ago or so, most people thought senility, the term that used to be used, was just a normal part of aging. So we wanted to make sure that people understood that diseases that cause memory symptoms are not normal. They're diseases of the brain, and few of them can be treated, but many of them can be helped. So that was sort of number one, is information. Number two was that once you get a proper diagnosis, to help people understand that some of the symptoms can be managed, even though the disease itself progresses. So that some people become, with Alzheimer's disease, become withdrawn or depressed or restless or agitated or suspicious. Each one of those can be targeted, and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the person with the disease does much better, and of course that helps the family and the caregiver. And then the third thing we wanted to do was to let people know what was happening in research and what might happen in the future. So those are sort of the three legs of the book, and why it's been so popular, of course, it's a little hard for me to know, but I think it's because we've addressed the hard parts clearly and directly and pointed out what some of the positives might be.
Now, let's get into some of this, if I can. Since you're an expert in Alzheimer's disease and the dementias in general, one of the things you talk about is the different phases of the disease and when and what is the wishes of the patient and how the caregiver interacts with those wishes. So let me just talk about when can a person write their advanced directives, their wishes? If they're in the what you call the first phase of Alzheimer's, can they are they still legally able to, and are they still capable in your mind of being able to direct how they want to be cared for later on?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that because it's a very important issue. First, because Alzheimer's is a very slowly progressive disease, the average person lives about 10 years, but for some people it's more rapid, and others live up to 20 or even 25 years in rare instances. At the beginning, the first symptoms that are noticeable to people are mild difficulties remembering new information, so memory problems at the beginning. After 3 or 4 years, people start to have some trouble expressing themselves, getting the words out that they want, or understanding what people say. some problems with perceiving the world accurately. I think it's distorted. And difficulty doing everyday things like a knife and fork, getting dressed, et cetera. So certainly, for the first 3 or 4 years, and oftentimes longer, really, people are able to understand when they're asked questions, like, you know, writing a will or going on an advanced practice. People know what their wishes are, and they're able to express them. I mean, in the ideal world, every single one of us, every listener, you and me, would already have an advanced directive before we ever become ill. But in the real world, way more than half of people still don't have one. And so one of the reasons I think to get a diagnosis early on would be that often pushes people to sit down with their loved ones, write an advanced directive, and discuss it with that person. And what I recommend to people is if you're lucky and you have someone you really trust, you discuss in detail, what are your values? One of the challenges of writing things down is that the subtlety can sometimes be lost. And if I can just give an example, many people say, I never want artificial feeding, or I never want to be on a breathing machine. Well, occasionally, those are only needed for a few days or a short period of time. And what most people really mean is, I don't want to permanently be on a breathing machine. And if they don't know that up front, that they've expressed that value to their loved one, you know, if I enter a state in which I'm sort of irretrievably unable to breathe on my own, I would not want to be on a breathing machine. That's a much more subtle discussion. So you can have that early on with people with the disease. And again, ideally, I'd be able to identify someone that would be able to do that with them.
Now, in addition to this, so I'm constantly reminded of, and because it was such a powerful film in my world, was the film Still Alice, I think it was called, where she put into her iPhone a way of committing suicide when she got to a certain point, but couldn't remember, as I remember, the password initially, and then then dropped the pills on the floor and couldn't remember why she was getting the pills out. How does one tell a loved one that they don't want to be at that state? Or is that even conceivable to do now?
Yeah, that's a tough question. First, I have to tell you my own belief.
I don't want to give you easy questions. Yeah. You're here
good.
For tough
that's
questions.
Absolutely perfect. No, I think this is very important to raise. I think, number one, I've had many patients, many people, and many normal older patients since I'm a geriatric psychiatrist, who said something like, if I ever developed Alzheimer's disease, I wouldn't want to live. And what I've found in many people is that a fair number of those people, probably a vast majority, change their mind. That it's hard for us to know in advance what is something going to be like. Most people who have cancer, for example, want to live as long as possible, but not everybody. So I think what we have to appreciate is that sometimes when we express something for the future, we can hopefully always change our mind if we learn new information or our feelings change. One of the difficulties of Alzheimer's disease, as you raised, is that people get to a point where they're no longer able to change their mind because they can't keep all the facts straight in their head. And I think Still Alice is a good example of that. So my own feeling is that if someone has expressed a prior wish, but they get to a point where they can't act on it, or they seem like maybe they've changed their mind or they're not sure, that's why if you have in your power of attorney, you've picked a person who can represent your values. They can help decide, you know, Dad told me this, we had this discussion. I'm not so sure he still wants that. I'm sure he does. So that would be one thing. I think the second thing is that physician-assisted suicide now is legal in a sense, but in the United States, it still requires that the person be competent when that occurs. So most people with Alzheimer's disease could not have physician-assisted death, even if that's something they express ahead of time, if they become incompetent. And again, so what happened in Jill Alice is she lost that ability to know what she had expressed before. So I think if your question is, well, should the person who's your power of attorney, health for health, push that on you or try to explain it? I think at that point, if the person really has lost that capacity, they've lost it. They really can't knowingly act on it. And my own feeling is that at that point, we don't know what they want currently. So even though it's a prior expressed wish, people always can change their mind. The hard part with Alzheimer's and other dementias is they lose that ability. So it is a very tough question.
More with Dr. Mike Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast coming up. We just want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by That's It. Did you know that only one-third of Americans get their proper servings of fruits and vegetables? At That's It, they made it their mission to fix this by finding a way to finally make produce portable while still preserving its nutritional value. That's It started with their famous fruit bars. You've probably seen them. They are made with only two ingredients, fruit and, well, fruit. That's it. Seriously. Now, after popular demand, they are changing the way you eat your veggies with That's It veggie bars, featured in four flavors, black beans and kale, peas, carrots, and corn. Each bar is under 100 calories, contains 4 grams of green protein, and like their fruit bars, contain no preservatives, are gluten-free, non-GMO, contain no fat, are kosher, vegan-friendly, and contain 4 grams of fiber. Each bar contains one full serving of vegetables. It's the simple and easy way to get your daily serving of veggies. Want to try it for yourself? Go to thatsitfruit.com and enter the code YOU, that's Y-O-U, to save 10% off any order today. They're only available online right now, but keep an eye out for them soon at your favorite local retailers. Once again, thatsitfruit.com with promo code YOU, that's Y-O-U, to save 10% off any order today. So don't forget to eat your veggies. Now back to Dr. Mike Roizen.
So coming back to the caregiver, there are very difficult issues for caregivers, but there also are some positive issues. So talk to us a little bit about what you see as the positive of current caregiving. And then before we end, I want to talk about therapies and where you think we're going to go in the next 10 years with therapies. But first, talk about the positives of the caregiving experience.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I don't want to sugarcoat the experience because being a caregiver is often very challenging emotionally and physically. In some ways, a person with the disease is dying, but they're not. And so there are a lot of emotional challenges. About a third of people, their personality changes. That can be very hard. And then there are all the physical care demands, which are a big challenge. But many caregivers say that they are rewarded by providing that care, that they can still provide loving care. They have many years of memories that sustain them. And so I think, and it gets back to your first question, what was it about the 36-hour day that helped people? We tried very hard to acknowledge how hard it can be, but we also tried to point out what you can do in spite of the disease. And I think this is a similar issue. Many caregivers report that they still feel very positive and they still have a loving relationship in spite of all the challenges. And you know, getting to the question of medications and treatments in the future, I think one of the things that sustains caregivers is the fact that maybe things will get better biologically or medically.
And Peter, talk to me about that. In other words, when someone enters a stage of Alzheimer's, what I guess you would call the second or maybe even a stage past that, and stop recognizing their surroundings, for example, is there any hope that we can reverse that? And what's your thoughts on when that will occur?
So first, the medicines that are approved by the FDA now do not change the biology of the disease. That is, they do help about a third of people, and sometimes their memory's a little bit better or they're better able to function in life. But the disease keeps progressing and killing brain cells. So right now, we don't have a treatment that can stop the disease or even raise the possibility of reversing it. So the current thought is that in order to do that, in order to either stop the disease in its tracks, but particularly to allow people to maybe have some hope of recovery, we're going to have to recognize the disease at the beginning or maybe even before the first symptom. It's now known that the brain changes of Alzheimer's disease, lesions that are called plaques and tangles, are forming in the brain 15 or possibly even 20 years before the first symptoms. So it may be that, and this is what most drug companies and scientists are working on, is trying to come up with first ways to recognize the disease before the symptoms develop, to recognize the changes in the brain. And then second, to develop treatments that actually remove these proteins called beta amyloid and tau, which are thought to trigger the disease. So the idea is you stop the cause of it and the symptoms never emerge. So we're not there yet. But I think a lot of people feel that from 5 or 10 years from now, we may well have drugs that can do that. And at that point, very, very early recognition is going to be key. Now, it's possible that some brain cells can regenerate and regrow and some of the connections can reform. But because the damage of Alzheimer's disease is so widespread, particularly by the time of the second or third stages, in your example, when people can't remember somebody in their family, it's hard to imagine that the brain can regrow all those connections. Now, anything's possible, and who knows what will happen with genetic engineering and that sort of thing. But that's why people are really focused now on very, very early recognition and stopping the process in its tracks before the first symptoms emerge.
So so one of the things we've learned is that the brain has plasticity. It can seem to grow and regrow and learn new things. And is that totally not possible once a certain stage of dementia has occurred, and you really have to practice? In other words, if you're listening to this and able to understand what we're talking about in this podcast, you've really got to start taking control of your brain right now and trying to do those 8 or 9 things that we know make a difference.
Yeah, another challenging question, but a great one. Well, so in a way, plasticity really refers to two things that are going on in the brain. One is making new brain cells. And until 10 or 15 years ago, scientists said, once you hit adulthood, you can't make any new brain cells. But now it's very clear that particularly in the area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the memory center, helps form new memories. New brain cells develop through life. So you can grow new brain cells. That's number one. But number two, plasticity really refers to strengthening connections between nerve cells. And part of what happens in Alzheimer's disease and probably some other dementias is that the connections between brain cells start to die. So that means they can't communicate with each other as well. And then eventually those cells themselves die because they're not being stimulated by the cells that they're connected to. It does certainly seem possible that if you could stop the Alzheimer's process, that maybe throughout the brain, some reconnections, the synapses are what it's called, between cells, that maybe they, if the cells are still there, they could reconnect. The thing is, once cells have died, right now we think that the only area that you're actually able to form new cells is in this memory area or hippocampus. Whereas a symptom like not recognizing familiar loved ones or losing ability to do early learned things like brush your teeth or use a knife and fork, those are controlled by other parts of the brain. And at least right now, it doesn't seem that you can, you can't grow, we don't think you're able to grow new brain cells in those other areas. So it's hard to see that that could recover. But I think it's possible, particularly in Alzheimer's at least, that if you could stop the disease, that new memory cells would form, and perhaps over time they might connect with other areas of the brain. Another disease where this, if I can just briefly say, is Parkinson's disease, where the damage is very localized. There, people are more hopeful that if you can stop the disease or maybe even do transplants of stem cells in that area, you might be able to put new cells that would then reconnect with other cells and then through the formation of the synapses, the connections, really actually lead to recovery. And some people with Parkinson's disease do have dementia. So it's probably different for every disease.
Now, let me go and ask a question that came in via our email line after we tweeted that we were talking to you today. And that was, there are some people who claim to see both disease reversal, disease stoppage, and disease reversal. And they quote, for example, the Bredesen protocol. And they said, is this just an experiment? Does it appear that one should change diet and lifestyle that much? Or are we still in the questioning stage of this?
Well, from my point of view, at least the scientific evidence that I've reviewed doesn't convince me that those claims are accurate. Now, you know, maybe more science will be done, which will actually show that. These are small studies are done usually in just one time in one place, so there's a lot of chance and that sort of thing. And very often, the comparison is not somebody who got a sugar pill or placebo, but it's more compared to what a typical Alzheimer patient would have done. And that you really can't draw the conclusion, at least in my opinion, that something is working when your comparison is what I would call an imaginary person who's had the disease, because every sample is different. Your question that you also asked, should people change their diet? And I think from a prevention point of view, it looks like, and again, the evidence is not super strong, but it's stronger in this prevention area, that if people go on to a so-called Mediterranean diet, where you minimize red meat, increase vegetables and fruit intake, olive oil instead of other fats, that may diminish the likelihood of developing cognitive decline, thinking impairment. No one has really shown that it prevents Alzheimer's yet. But I still think the evidence is good enough now where that kind of a diet may well at least delay things or slow them down. And there's beginning to be some evidence of people who have already some symptoms that helping them remain physically active and mentally active may also have benefits in slowing the disease progression down.
Peter, this is wonderful, and I know what people get from listening to this and will get from listening to this is the deep understanding that you have about this disease and the impressive ability to find things out through the book, The 36-Hour Day, which is really a Bible for caregivers as well as for all the rest of us, and I don't know of anyone who hasn't been touched by Alzheimer's or dementia, meaning family member doing being a caregiver or watching a caregiver or worrying about it. this obviously is a, and I want to thank you for such a incredible contribution to all of the rest of us as well as to this podcast. We've been listening to Peter Rabins, Dr. Peter Rabins, R-A-B-I-N-S, obviously a superb expert who's done this a long time and gets our understanding and gets an important contribution for all of us. Dr. Rabins, thank you very much. We'll be back next week with another podcast with a guest, but I don't think we could ever have a guest as good as you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
We'll be back next week. Every Tuesday, we release a new one, You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast, the best medical news of the week with action steps. It's not just the discoveries, it's what you can do with it, as well as great guests. But again, we had a superb guest today. Hope you'll listen to this one again and again. I will. Thanks very much for listening. And Ben, you for great engineering. We'll be back next week.